guys, thanks for coming. This is, as you will notice, one of the things we try to do in this seminar series is team up with the various fantastic regional area seminar groups that are going on in Oxford so that we're having joint events. This is another of our joint events. This time with the Horn of Africa seminar. We're very pleased, I should say, to make it very clear that all of the work was done by this man here and none of it by me, so thank you very much to Jason. And Jason is going to be chairing the session today, so I will simply introduce Jason by saying Jason's been a long-term friend of many of us here, working previously for Oxford Analytica, now at Chatham House, and we're very grateful that he stayed with a strong link to the African Studies Centre as a research associate, and that he plays a key role in the Horn of Africa seminar. So thank you very much for your support of the centre, and over to you to introduce the speakers.
Thanks, Nick. And I should begin by saying this is a great opportunity, and thanks, Nick, for making it available. And that I'm not going to do any of the work today because of these three folks who've come to join us are going to do all of that. With Ahmed of our local community as well, joining in to sort of lead the discussion off. So I'm just going to briefly introduce the panelists. We're going to be talking about the crisis in South Sudan. Obviously, this has been kicking off since the middle of December. Last week, we had a ceasefire agreement signed. I think yesterday, we had a few detainees, or maybe even this morning, some of the political detainees released. Still conflict, 600,000 or something folks displaced or made into refugees, about a third of whom are receiving some kind of service. That's not a very nice situation. And so we're going to be talking a bit about the historical context, a bit about the regional stakes, and a bit about sort of external intervention from without the region before we start the discussion. So we've got three panelists and an excellent respondent. Leading off the discussion will be Dr. Douglas Johnson, who's on my right. He's well known to this community here at St. Anthony's, the African Studies Center and African Studies at Oxford in general. He's the author of The Root Causes of Sudan's Civil Wars. He was a member of the expert panel on the Abyei border issue and an analyst of longstanding of the region. He's going to speak to the salient elements of the historical context to ground the current dynamics. Annette Weber, from on my left, is currently the head of research for the Middle East and Africa at Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik, which is the German Institute for International and Security Studies, which is kind of Chatham House's sister organization or peer organization in Berlin. Previous to that appointment, she was based in Addis Ababa for a few years with responsibility for the Horn of Africa. She's a longstanding also observer of the region and of South Sudan. She did, was reminded earlier, her PhD focused in part on the role of women in the SPLA. Annette will speak to the interests of the regional players in the Horn of Africa, particularly IGAD, as well as some other comments that she wants to throw into the mix. And then finally on our panel, we've got Peter Biar-Ajak, who's come to us from Cambridge today. Peter is the founder and director of the Center for Strategic Analyses and Research in Juba. He's also working on a PhD in Cambridge at the moment with Sharath Srinivasan, formerly of this parish, who's in Nairobi at the moment. So Peter's worked on development questions facing South Sudan through his center, and previous to that, economic and political. So he's going to be speaking to the politics and the efficacy of external intervention. And then we will have our respondent, Dr. Ahmed Ashahi, who's a research fellow here at St. Anthony's, and the head of the Sudanese program, the Middle East Center, which is also based in St. Anthony's. And he will lead off the discussion with a sort of 10-minute response. All of our speakers will have about 20 minutes maximum. And then we'll move to open discussion after the first response by Dr. Shai. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Douglas.
Thank you. If any of you have been listening to the World Service or Al Jazeera or Deutsche Welle or even the Radio Voice of Russia over the last few weeks, you might find what I'm saying a bit repetitive, but I will try to say something different. than I have been required to say over since this all began. I have a book here that was written by one of the people who's been accused of planning a coup. And though he wasn't detained for very long, he's among those who have been either exiled or sent to Kenya. Peter Adwork Nyaba, a book called South Sudan, The State We Aspire To. It was published in 2011, the year of independence, and it was a critique of how the government of South Sudan and the SPLM in particular had been performing during the interim period leading up to the referendum. And he had a number of criticisms, both political in policy, but also personal. Now, one thing that we have to remember is that South Sudan has never really had the experience of any sort of regular parliamentary democracy. It was basically excluded during the first 15 years or so of Sudanese independence, first under the parliamentary government, then under the first military government, was not really very active during the second parliamentary government because the civil war was already raging in the south. And then under Nimeiri, the SSU, Sudan Socialist Union, a one-party state, people who had any political aspirations usually were able to fulfill them by appointment, not through the experience of building a constituency or representing a constituency and being able to demonstrate that they represented a constituency. And therefore, a lot of the focus of attention, not only in previous years, but also within the SPLM during the Second Civil War, was the focus on the leader and the people around him and the shifting constellation of persons who were appointed or became close to the leader or were then expelled. And that's very much the way in which a lot of the critique that Peter Adwork wrote in this book has been a focus on the sort of shifting sands, so to speak, of people who seek to influence a leader through seek preferment through closeness to a leader. And he saw a crisis in the SPLM beginning quite naturally with the death of John Garang and the elevation of Salva Kiir as his second in command to being both president of South Sudan and first vice president of Sudan, and the way in which there were a number of groups that maneuvered to try to get close to him, to influence the policies of government, as well as people who were became in and then people who became out. And his first criticism was of a group of South Sudanese politicians who were not necessarily part of the SPLM. They were, in fact, what he called the Kanana group. Now, the Kanana group, this is a name that was applied to a group of opponents of the SPLM, many with close ties to the National Congress Party and with the regime in Khartoum, who during the interim period met in Kanana, had a meeting that was sponsored by the Kanana Sugar Corporation, to work out a policy in opposition to the SPLM during that interim period. Just if Kanana sounds like a familiar name to you, the Kanana Corporation has also been a funder of the Sudanese program here in St. Anthony's.
No longer, sorry, if you could correct you, no longer.
Well, they have been declared a patron of St. Anthony's.
Indeed, that's no longer. They refuse to support us.
Well, that's very good to hear.
You know, you have to get the facts right.
I have got the facts right, as far as St. Anthony's was willing to publicize them. Okay. Now, during the first few years of the interim period, according to Peter Adwork's critique, you had people who were not close to the SPLM who were very much influencing Salva Kiir, so that many of the old guard of the SPLM, SPLA were being marginalized, especially people like from the north, northern Sudan, like Yasser Aman and Abdul Aziz, but also other people from within South Sudan. And this had an effect on the way in which the CPA was implemented. Then the people who had been involved in this group became on the outs, and there was more of a resurrection or return to old established SPLA, SPLM leaders in the regional government, or in the southern government. Now, since independence, there has been another shift. And one of the things that has certainly concerned a lot of the people in not only within the SPLM but within South Sudan is the way in which there has been a shift away from policies of the SPLM and a much closer political alliance or at least accommodation with Khartoum. Now, some of the issues. First of all, one of the things that came to the head was the issue of who was going to succeed Salva Kiir in the 2015 elections. Was anybody going to succeed Salva Kiir? Was Salva Kiir going to stand for re-election? But there were other issues that were of importance that began to cause divisions within the SPLM. For instance, Abyei. The lack of progress over the Abyei issue and the way in which the government in Juba seemed not to make this a priority certainly disturbed people like Deng Alor, who was from Abyei. Issues over the border, issues over the negotiations over oil. Pagan Amum, who was the Secretary General of the SPLM, took a much harder line about the sharing of oil revenues or the transfer negotiation of transfer fees than Salva Kiir was eventually willing to accept. Up to July 2013, there was a very open and vigorous debate, both within the SPLM and outside of the SPLM, about where was the government going, what was the direction of the party, what was the direction of the government. There were issues, concerns about security, rising levels of insecurity in the Jonglei state, issues about corruption, but there was also a growing suppression of this debate, one by the state security organizations harassing journalists, and then in July of 2013, Salva Kiir dismissed his entire cabinet and replaced them with people, many of whom were from outside of the SPLA. In fact, some Dr. Riak Guy, who is Minister of Health, was the leader of the National Congress Party in the South. So this became more of a focus within the SPLM of the political conflict and the political disagreements that led to the confrontation in December, where you had a coalition of people from within the SPLM who were worried about, concerned about the direction it was taking and the movement was taking, the government was taking. They weren't necessarily natural allies. Riek Machar, who had been the vice president, had been dismissed along with the cabinet. He didn't necessarily have the support of people like Pagan Amum or Deng Alor, or other of the people who were stalwarts of the SPLM and had been stalwarts during the 1990s when Riek Machar led his own breakaway group. But they, as a matter of political convenience or political necessity, they all of them had worries about where the government was going and where the party was going, and worries about how the influence of people who were not from within the SPLM, the influence they were beginning to have on the direction of government, on accommodation with Khartoum over security issues, for instance. Edward Lino, who had been the boss of state security in South Sudan, also came from Abyei, was also dismissed. And so there was quite a lot of anxiety about what was going to happen. If you look then at the press conference that took place and then the press statement that was issued on December 8th, you will see that a lot of the issues that were raised, one, the marginalization of Garang stalwarts in the party, various other aspects were the sorts of things that were high in the minds of people like Dengelor and Paganamum and others, but not necessarily anything that really exercised, for instance, Riak Machar, who was not a Garang stalwart, but whose ambition to run for president was quite clear. Now, in any sort of democratic society, all politicians have ambitions, so they can't be criticized for having ambition. It was a matter of the uncertainty of what was happening in the SPLM that a lot of people were not necessarily throwing their hats in the ring, but they were getting hats and getting ready to throw them in the ring should the ring open up. There was a certain amount of doubt about what Salva Kiir was going to do. Now, as Salva Kiir began to lose support from within the SPLM, he began to turn towards his own community from northern Bahr-Ghazal to bolster his support. This is where he began to recruit, or where it is alleged, reported that he began to recruit people from northern Bahr-Ghazal and Warab State into a special military unit, which was under his command and not necessarily under the command, within the command structure of the SPLA. So that is the background to the political crisis. One, drift within the SPLM. Two, criticisms about drift within the government of South Sudan. Three, a fear from within, anxiety within the SPLM about the increasing influence of people who are now being brought in to surround Salva Kiir, and increased suppression, not only within the SPLM of suppressing dissent, but outside of the SPLM with more vigorous suppression of the media in reporting criticisms or raising criticisms. Now, what we have, of course, in this crisis are two conflicts that were developing that have eventually merged. I've talked about the crisis within the government and within with the party, but there was a second crisis within the army. Now, the SPLA, at the time of the CPA, the security provision included the continuation of the SPLA. The SPLA was not absorbed into the Sudan Armed Forces, as the old Anyanya had been after with the Addis Ababa Agreement. But there were a number of militias that had been operating that had been supported by Khartoum and were anti-SPLA militias during the war. And the provision of the CPA was that they had to decide where they would go. Would they join the SPLA or would they join the Sudan Armed Forces? Now, most of them joined the SPLA. Some of them remained outside of the SPLA throughout the interim period. And after 2011, some more of those that had been outside of the SPLA were brought back in. And these were groups that had been recruited from specific areas within South Sudan, very largely in the states of Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity, and very largely from specific Nuer groups. Now, the SPLA certainly contained a lot of new air, and there was a policy of trying to integrate and the units, but a lot of these old militias remained incompletely integrated into the SPLA. And there were a number of defections of people throughout the interim period, either coming into the SPLA and then going back out with support of Khartoum. And after 2011, you also had various groups that continued to be supported by Khartoum. So instead of the SPLA reducing in numbers, it was constantly increasing its numbers. There was no real provision for in what was known as disarmament, demobilization, and rehabilitation, because there was no provision for people who were in the army to have a livelihood outside of the army. So you had an unwieldy structure. You had certainly groups that were armed, but their discipline was and training was questionable, as was their motivation. In addition to that, there was a lot of pressure on Salva Kiir to cease support for the SPLA North operating in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile across the border from South Sudan. United States was one country that kept on urging Juba to cease its support for their former comrades in these areas. And certainly this was an issue that was up for negotiation between Khartoum and Juba, because Khartoum was also continuing to support armed groups that were operating low-level insurgencies in South Sudan. And last year, a number of SPLA officers, high-ranking officers, about 176, were dismissed from the army, and these were ones who had been very strongly supportive of the SPLA North across the border. So there was an imbalance within the SPLA as a result of, one, incorporating these former Khartoum militias, incompletely integrating them into the army, and dismissing people who were old-time stalwarts of the SPLA. Now, I won't go into the account of how the fighting in Juba and elsewhere started. It's difficult to know from the different accounts. Very few people outside of South Sudan accept the government's claim that a coup was being planned. However, there certainly was some sort of division within the military at some level. And we do know that there were a lot of people who were killed in Juba who were civilians, and they were killed by people in uniform. And a lot of the people who were killed were either the bodyguards of Riek Machar or their families or other Nuer. And shortly after that news came out, you had the defections in Jonglei State and in Unity State with Peter Gaudet, who is a serial defector. I don't know that even he knows who he supports other than himself. And he had only recently come back into the SPLA and had been put in charge of the disarmament program in Jonglei that was supposed to bring security to Jonglei and end the constant fighting between the Lao Nuer and the Morlaix. What you then have, what has been described as an ethnic conflict, is in fact mainly focused within the SPLA. And that the people who are killing other people are men in uniform more than any sort of mobilization of civilians. Other than the recent mobilization of the Nuer militias that had already armed themselves and organized themselves to fight the Morlaix and Jonglei, and who have now sided with the groups that have defected and have been fighting Juba. It is quite clear to me that Riek Machar, who is described as being in charge of these forces, is not in charge. It's quite clear to me that you have different commanders, different groups operating, that there may be some coordination between them, but Riek is showing the same failure of command and leadership that he showed in the 1990s, when he tried to mobilize a coup against Jean Garang and ended up having to rely on different groups of Nuer. Now, the people who have been accused of planning a coup include Dinka, as well as Nuer, as well as Shuluk, as well as other people. The people who have been on the side of the government include Nuer. The chief of staff, Hoth Mai, is a Nuer. The foreign minister, Mario Benjamin, is a Nuer. Minister for Health, Riek Guy, who is also one of the negotiating team on the government side, is a Nuer. And the Nuer, the army that has retaken Bentiu from the defecting troops, is largely made of Nuer. So this can't really be seen as the sort of thing that has been described as another Rwanda, nor can it be seen as an all-out war between Nuer and Dinka. It is very much a legacy of the war and a legacy of the way in which weapons were distributed and people mobilized, either in militias or the SPLA or in private armies, and very much a failure of the interim period when the government, the SPLM and the SPLA did not focus very much attention on how to bring about a reconciliation of the populations that have been affected by the war. This is something that should have been done in the 6-year interim period and never really was done. So just to conclude, I'll say that there, as I said, there are two different conflicts that have now merged. One is the political conflict within the SPLA, but within the government of South Sudan more broadly, and one is the conflict within the SPLA. They now have become entwined. It is possible to disentangle them, but it is only possible to do that to open up the sort of dialogue and debate about the direction of the country and about the direction of government that the government shut down last July.
Thanks, Douglas. I'm going to move right along to Aneta so we can keep this conversation rolling along and get to the discussion.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you, Douglas, for this very comprehensive view. And I think I would like to take on maybe two questions that come from what you just described, maybe as assumptions with huge implications of how the regional dynamics will roll, but also how potential, we don't want to call it solutions, but potential next steps could unfold. And I think what is important to me, what you also mentioned, is it's not just a binary, it's not just Riek Salva Kiir issue. But my question, and that's I have no solution, I have no answer fully to this, is it a more atomized conflict where you have more and more entrepreneurs of violence disconnecting from the structure of SPLA? Or do you have different commanders in SPLA where you could potentially, as you know, as an implication for solutions, bring them back in whatever, if we can call it power sharing, if it's truth and reconciliation? But I think if it's a more atomized, more fragmented political and military dynamic that we might see, then the spillover effects and the dynamics in the region will be very different. And I think the assumption, and there I jump into the regional and connected maybe with the international hope or expectations, was that it can be stabilized. And I think stability, again, is the overarching hope and expectation from all sides, that it can be stabilized. by putting some forces, you know, in addition to help, for example, Salva Kiir's forces, Salva Kiir's part of SPLA, to basically find a first military solution, to find a first solution for this political conflict by pushing, for example, Ugandan troops in. Now, if the assumption is that there is more of an atomized, more of a different groups with different interests reaching into the region, then I think the implications will be very much more critical and not so easy to review or to solve. I would like to just sum up three, I think, interesting developments we've seen. One is a very rapid response by IGAD. That has not been the case before. IGAD was on the conflict in Juba only a couple of days after the conflict started. I think this very rapid response and the responsibility taken by IGAD member states to have a political approach to this political conflict is very remarkable. And, you know, if we discuss further steps, I think this has not only to be acknowledged, but also to be seen how this step can be, can be supported. I think this is one of the interesting developments. And two more, to see the two different sides, Uganda and Ethiopia, are taken in this, or to have more pronounced profiles of these two countries that so far have always been much more interested in their own, let's say, national stability. Now we see Ethiopia, at least for the moment, almost playing a political role as a regional power, which they have not done so before. If you compare Ethiopia's position regarding Sudan and South Sudan with their position in Somalia, there is a change. There is a change in approach, and it seems to be, for the moment, and we might look into the reasons for this, much more of a, let's say, political, not only power broker, but negotiator. Whereas Uganda, being one of the troop deployers for almost all AU missions, from AMISOM to the Central African Republic, playing much more of a role of, let's say, the military might in the region, to have much more of a military profile, a strong military profile, as opposed to the more political profile that Ethiopia is playing. And you see this going back and forth. Seyoum Mesfin not being so happy about Ugandans' push or Ugandans' deployment, massive deployment into the war, and being outspoken about this. Also, this is new because Ethiopians so far are not known to be so outspoken about their Eastern African semi-attached neighbors, which they might not consider allies, but they were not so outspoken about this before. And I think there we can see some dynamics that will be, that will be determining how the regional spillover can be either contained or not contained. I would like to start. I would like to start with Sudan when we go around, because Sudan's role is not so clear. I mean, it's clear. What is clear is Sudan's interest. Sudan's interest is very clear in terms of keeping the oil flowing. Sudan's internal domestic issues are massive. The split in the NCP might seem a thing of the past, but it's boiling in the NCP. It's not just the reformists; it's other disgruntled elements in the NCP not being happy about Bashir, not being happy about the performance of the army. And almost parallel to the dismissal of SPLA high-ranking army members, you had this a year before in the army of Khartoum, in the SAF. So you have changes there in the army, you have changes there in the NCP. And of course, Sudan being interested not only in the oil, but also in the control, let's say, of the buffering states. As we all know, of course, the Sudan is using the conflict in South Sudan right now for more of a military offensive on Southern Kordofan and Southern Blue Nile, trying to benefit, let's say, from what's happening in South Sudan. And I think this is where an interesting link comes in, that Salva Kiir was able to call Malik Agar to defend Malakal with him. So he was able to take some of the SPLM North battalions out, or some of the fighters out, from where they actually have active warfare going on, to defend southern territory against Riek Machar's troops. I think this is an interesting and very worrying sign. I would say it's a worrying sign, but of course it's beneficial to Sudan. You can see GEM at the moment losing a bit of power, and this is where I would like to go from Sudan anti-clockwise, I think it is, to the neighboring conflict area of the Central African Republic, where you have Central African Republic, Chad, and Darfur being reconnected again as a conflict cluster. What we've seen in the last couple of weeks is Seleka, the Jotodia's forces, moving back into Chad, not being welcomed by Deby. So we have no confirmation of where these troops or where these armed groups will end up. But you could foresee that this conflict cluster that was very active in the mid-2000s could become another conflict cluster again. And of course, Khartoum would want to keep some control there as well. And of course, these armed elements, or these atomized entrepreneurs of violence, as you could call them, might also link up with elements in Juba as well. So I think this is where we should be much more worried about these potential links. Then DRC, I don't think there is too much spillover for the moment. But I think it's important to see that the splits in Equatoria and southern Sudan are not clearly just for or against Riyadh or for or against here. And I think when Ladu left Juba and mobilized in Equatoria, that's also something we have to see how this will work out if this group will come back into whatever power sharing agreement in the future South Sudan, or if again this link with Uganda, DRC and Central Africa will become more prominent. Uganda, of course, not only by being a strong ally with the SPLA throughout, but mainly because of their own interests and their 150,000 Ugandans living and working in South Sudan, of their interest of the Lamu oil pipeline as an opposition to the oil pipeline to Port Sudan, and as an interest to have a profile of a military might in the region. And I think this is where the rapid reaction of Uganda going in, denying that they're in, but then even with the backing of their Ugandan parliament, playing a huge and massive role. I think it's too early to say what conflict clusters and what kind of regional dynamics from Equatoria to Uganda can spill out. But of course, when you see the refugee streams, even this will definitely become an issue for Uganda to deal with, and where military positions in South Sudan will not be beneficial to them. Then when we go to Kenya also doesn't have so much of a profile right now. I think the first response by Kenyatta was seen by many as trying to, let's say, use the conflict in South Sudan to get out of the ICC bill, and trying to hide one thing with the other. That doesn't seem to be the case right now, and I think Kenyatta, by accommodating the former detainees, will be drawn in to that conflict. Not only Kenyatta, but Kenya will be drawn into that conflict much more on a political level. Kenya, of course, being very active in South Sudan, the whole banking sector in South Sudan was basically Kenyan dominated, and of course Kenyan's interest in the Lamu corridor and in the pipeline is huge, besides the hope and the issue of stability that I think is driving all of them. And then almost closing the circle, Ethiopia, as said before, Ethiopia's role as a political negotiator in the region, or a regional power player, didn't start now with the conflict in South Sudan. It started before with Abyei and the deployment of UNISFA. It started during Meles Zenawi's reign, where he and now Dizal and Zeyu Mesfin would play their interest in terms of keeping their borders calm, would also play their interest in, let's say, a regional balance, that Sudan or South Sudan would not fall either fully with the Eastern Africa or fully with the Sudan, but be in this balance where Ethiopia can play a role, where Ethiopia will, in the potential future, will be the power provider, the energy provider for all this, and where Ethiopia doesn't have an interest for South Sudan to become a full member of either one or the other group. So I think this is, of course, an interest that in the current situation is a balance in, it's a balancing interest that makes, that gives them, not only the reason, but also the power to be a powerful political player in this. I think I would rather leave it here very shortly and hope for further discussions on this. So thank you.
Thanks. All right. I will turn it over to Peter to continue to pick this up with the sort of linkages, external linkages theme. And build out from the region.
Well, let me first start by thanking Douglas and Annette for providing the historical background of the conflict and the scope of the conflict as we speak. As they have mentioned, it is essentially a crisis of institutions, of political institutions, governance institutions, and security institutions in South Sudan that resulted from the ill transformation of the SPLM-SPLA into a political party, a government, and an army. And as we have seen in the last few days, because of this lack of robust institutions, simple things like struggle over power or things like personal ambitions have been able to plunge the country back to the conflict. And it's a conflict that has also taken ethnic dimensions, as they have also mentioned, one that has been overstressed, but one that is very real, as people on the ground are witnessing. And it's also a conflict that has already involved regional actors. The role of Uganda is quite clear and is also one of the stumbling blocks to the peace process, as the rebels are demanding for the Ugandan troops to be withdrawn from the conflict. And it's also affecting IGAD itself in terms of neutrality, because the peace agreement is being hosted by IGAD. And Uganda is a member of IGAD, and with Uganda already having forces on the ground, is a real worrying sign. But in terms of thinking about the external actors and the multilateral actors beyond the region, as we speak in South Sudan, there is a very heavy presence of the United Nations security forces in the country. There is the UNMISS, the United Nations mission in South Sudan, that was deployed immediately after the independence of South Sudan. And it was a continuation of the already existing UN mission in Sudan that was deployed after the signing of the peace agreement. And this is a very big troop. It consists of about 12,500 troops and 1,320 police. And recently, the number has been increased as a result of this recent conflict, with extra troop being pulled out from the Congo mission and being sent to South Sudan. Now, this force in South Sudan is deployed under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, and they are supposed to provide three critical elements in regard to the Section 3 of the Status of Force Agreement between the United Nations and the government of South Sudan. One is to support the government of the Republic of South Sudan in providing security to its people, and this involves coordinating with the military, supporting the military, supporting the police in assisting the government to do one of its fundamental roles. The other one is to deter violence, especially violence that is aimed at civilians. As we have seen in recent days, there was a time just on the, I think it was 19th of December, when a UN mission in Akobo in Jonglei was stormed by 2,000 armed youth from Law Nuer that wanted to attack Dinka civilians that were taking refuge in the United Nations missions. And about seven United Nations troops from the Indian contingency end up losing their lives in that conflict. So part of the two end up dying. And earlier in Jonglei State, there were seven others that were attacked. So this is one of the roles that the United Nations is supposed to play there under existing agreement. And the other part is also to provide security to the UN and humanitarian agencies that are operating in the country. As we have seen, the conflict has taken a very serious humanitarian dimension. A lot of people are displaced, and they are in areas where basic needs are very difficult to be met. Now, among all of these agencies deployed in South Sudan, the United Nations, the European Union, the United States, many of them are headed by individuals that have very strong relationship with the South Sudanese authorities. If you take, for example, the United Nations mission is headed by Hilda Johnson, who during her time as Norway Minister of International Cooperation was very involved in the peace agreement and has very deep relationship with the president and with the leadership of the country. The same time, if you look at the United States, the embassy is being headed by Susan Page, who was also involved in the peace process and very strongly also linked with the government officials there. And during the entire time before this crisis, and definitely before the independence of South Sudan, there was a very close relationship between the external actors and the government official in South Sudan, because by then, South Sudan was more worried about the North and wanted the backing of the international actors, particularly these countries, to support its process and its journey towards independence. Now, immediately after the independence, the relationship began to deteriorate. And there were a number of issues that could be blamed for this process. The number one issue was the issue of the oil shutdown, where the government of South Sudan shut down the oil as a means of pressuring Sudan in the ongoing on the negotiations on how to share the oil and the transit fees that South Sudan was to pay. The other issues were the shortcoming on the governance side, and these were issues of corruption that were beginning to become a real worrying sign for the country, issues of insecurity, especially with threats to journalists and some assassinations of individuals in South Sudan that were beginning to worry international community. The other issues were also the disarmament that Douglas mentioned before, especially the one that was taking place in Jonglei, that was also combined with operations that were targeting another rebel groups that it was operating in Jonglei State, headed by David Yao Yao, who is from Murule community. And this operation ended up taking very serious humanitarian dimension with severe human rights abuses that it started to cause worrying signs from the international community. At the same time, the conflict, for the first time, raised question of neutrality of the United Nations. One of the incidents that happened during that time was that the SPLA shot down a UN helicopter, and it was alleged that this helicopter was shot down because it was supplying the rebels with arms and ammunition. And at that time also, there are information that the government of Sudan was using helicopters that were painted white as if they belonged to the UN to supply the rebels in Jonglei. So there were clear, there were very unclear lines there as to who exactly was involved and what were the issues. But recently, as we speak, the relations have really gone bad in the recent days, with the government accusing the United Nations and the other Western countries of siding with the rebels and trying to orchestrate a regime change agenda in South Sudan. And particularly after it became clear that the rebels commandeer some of the UN vehicles in Jonglei State and some of the UN food, which to the government seems as if it was UN that gave those vehicles and those items to the rebels as a way of supporting the rebels. And obviously there exists also part of the historical background in which during our own war with the North, we knew exactly what the UN do sometime when they take side and how they use some of humanitarian items as part of also involving in this politics. So in thinking of further intervention, especially from the external side, the first question would be is what would be the aim of such intervention? Because as we speak already, you have a huge force of the United Nations whose specific mandate is to protect civilians. So that is something that does not need to be negotiated anymore. It's something that has already been agreed. You have the UN troops that are already on the ground. So as we speak, it would be difficult to imagine what an extended intervention from the external actors would actually accomplish when already exists a clear agreed mandate of the United Nations with the forces on the ground to protect civilians, because normally intervention is either to protect the civilians or to enhance the environment for humanitarian support, which is already the case because the UN troops are also there to provide support to the UN agencies, the humanitarian agencies, to provide humanitarian services to the people. The other thing, too, is in the last days, rhetorics have really gone up. The president of South Sudan has accused UN of running a parallel government in South Sudan that is undermining the functioning of the government. And already a few days ago, there was a demonstration in Juba in which hundreds of youth were calling for Hilda Johnson to be removed and for the UNMISS to be redeployed from South Sudan. So if there is a more level of intervention, it would be difficult how the people will actually perceive it, especially in a conflict that has already taken a very serious ethnic undertones and ethnic dimension. The other issue, too, is how would the region react to it? As Annette mentioned, there's already clear regional interest on the ground that may be actually contradictory to each other. Uganda has clearly taken the side of the government. The rest of the countries are unclear. Kenya seemed to be taking a political ground. Ethiopia is not yet sure what it wants, but is very worried about the presence of Ugandans in South Sudan. The same thing with Sudan. Recently, the presidential advisor on legal affairs was in Khartoum to deliver a special message from South Sudan president to President Omar al-Bashir, and it's unclear what was in that message. There has been talk of a joint force of South Sudan and Sudan to protect the oil fields, but it's unclear exactly if South Sudan would follow through on those things. The same thing also, as I mentioned, the rest of IGAD countries, especially Eritrea, which is already being accused of taking the side of the rebels, it's unclear what would an extended international intervention would do in regard to those regional interests that are already quite clear. The other thing to also mention is the existing UN force, which is one of the largest that is deployed in the world, is already unable to protect civilians. As I mentioned before, there was a case in which a UN compound was overrun in Akobo. And even the camps that are already functioning, the one in Juba, the one in Bor, the one in Malakal, and the one in Bentiu, they're operating beyond their capacity. When you talk sometime with some of the people taking refuge there, they talk about lack of water, lack of basic things that UN is already proving is unable to carry out some of its own mandate, especially in its own territory, in its own UN compound. And now we are not even talking about the rest of the country, because in the rest of the country, people are moving around, people are getting attacked, and the UN is unable because the force that they have, although is large, is inadequate to do the kind of work that is needed at this time. So it would be very unclear what kind of force would be required to actually do anything that would be meaningful in intervening in the crisis. Obviously, it seems here the situation, the need is stability, to return the country back to where it was before this crisis has begun. And it would be difficult to see that happening as a result of a more robust external intervention. I think beyond the current discussion that is going on sanctions, targeted sanctions that are aimed at some of the individuals that are making it difficult for the peace to be achieved, it's difficult to see what a more robust external intervention will do in this crisis, if not to worsen it.
Thanks, Peter. Okay, well, that's quite a full
indeed. I mean, 10 plate. Minutes, but I'll try very, very briefly. First, I want to correct misconception by Dr. Johnson. 3 years ago, Kinana Sugar Factory refused to support us because Bona advocated self-determination and because he is Southerners. So for 3 years, we have not received a single penny, and we don't receive any money from any outside tied up to any kind of political, ethnic, religious prescription. So that's for you. So you must remember that, please. So don't go around and sort of give a false impression on the Cedis program funding. Okay? Yes, we gave him. Yes, we gave him. We gave them, certainly, before they canceled their support to us. Mm. Indeed.
Well, let's draw a line under that. And
yes,
get
but
back
I mean,
to
I just want to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
So
thanks.
Now let me see the three speakers. Dr. Johnson highlight the ethnic conflict, the personality conflict in southern Sudan in the present day, and he goes back into history to 2005, we started, and rely on Peter and Niaba. Absolutely correct what he says, but I don't know about, and I wish that you could tell the audience about Kinana Group, what were they doing, what were they saying, what were they planning against the South. So that's really missing. Annette is excellent regional perspective on the problem of the South. It could be what happened in the South, destabilizing, you know, the countries around the Sudan, but also a source of stability because of interference from these countries, including, by the way, Northern Sudan. Mm-hmm. So now we come to Peter. Yes, indeed, crisis of political institution, and I think here, none of you, which is terribly surprising, it's a major cause of the instability of that. You hinted at corruption. Corruption is extremely thriving in the South. None of you said anything why even those who were released today, seven of them, they still have to stand trial for embezzlement of money. It's extraordinary that within 2 years, the state has been cleansed of any funding. The goodwill of the international community, the money was given from the outside, and the oil money, it just disappeared. And I think really, you three of you, you should have really hinted at this is the cause. In a sense, what we are talking about the South is power, dominance, and exploitation. So from liberator, the SPLA, came to what? Persecutor of their own people with each other. So I don't think, you know, the Southern Sudanese intellectuals or elite or educated people should blame Britain as the source of the conflict between North and South, or should blame America, or should blame the present day Northern Sudan, but they should blame themselves for the state of affairs into what's happening at the present time. Now, people say, what is the cause? We have sort of historical, this has been caused. But basically, the state is very weak. There is no legitimacy for the state. The state built on ethnic affiliation. Positions, if you look at any mysteries within the South, all the ministers, they have to bring their own people around to protect them from each other. So the ethnicity is translated into government institution, and that's not really conducive to bringing consensus among Southern Sudanese to run their affairs. So the struggle over power, if Riek Machar, if he is really genuine, he should have waited for the next general election and stand for election and see whether he wins. Good luck to him if he wins. But to raise arm against Salva Kiir, it only intensified personal problem between them, but also create a rift between Dinka and Nuer. Frankly, I don't think our speakers here think, you know, stability could be brought in. I doubt if stability is going to be a prominent thing in the South. The conflict is going to go on, and heaven knows what the dimension of that, of this present day conflict. What we are doing, I mean, you know, traditionally, Southern Sudanese tribe, whether Dinka and Nuer, they have been known for, throughout history, for raiding cattle and raiding each other. The blood feud is very common, like Arabs, all these tribal, you know, sort of nomadic people. This is a kind of blood feud. The Dinka are not going to stay quiet, and neither the Nuer will stay quiet. So they go on killing each other, and whether United Nations, America, or Northern Sudan, or surrounding country is going to douse this with water, saying no more, you know, killing with each other. So what is really talking about the stability in the South, I think is really very, very extremely important for the international community to help Southern Sudanese, is that patience, what is required, commitment to the state, not to region or not to tribe. The Southerners have to really, you know, choose between a state and between tribe. If you go the tribe, this is what happens. And if you choose the state, at least the international community should help Southern Sudanese to build up a state based on consensus and based on fairness, not appointment due to ethnic affiliation. So this is how I see the present day situation in the South. And I hope that our colleagues here could reply to some of the issues I have raised. And thank you very much.
Thank you.